after Sheldon Oker and Joe Morgan, one of the greatest players under 6 feet in the history of baseball. It is such a pleasure to approach a microphone and not have to lower it. It is also a genuine pleasure to be introduced by Joe Morgan, an all-time great player, as he said, a longtime friend, and a guy I spent countless good times with in the broadcast booth. My thanks to Commissioner Rob Manfred, to James Fords Clark, to Jeff Idelson, and to the entire staff of the National Baseball Hall of Fame for their extraordinary kindness and hospitality, not only this weekend, but in the months leading up to it. Congratulations and respect as well to Sheldon Oker. A pleasure to be part of this day with you, and in a sense, to share this weekend with Jack Morris, Alan Trammell, Trevor Hoffman, Vlad Guerrero, Jim Thome, and Chipper Jones. Take a look around, Sheldon. We're in darn good company. My thanks as well to Joe Buck for narrating the opening to the clip reel you just saw. It's only a matter of time until Joe joins his dad as the first father and son in baseball's Broadcasting Hall of Fame. My first trip to the Hall of Fame came on the summer day in 1974 when Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford entered the hall. Since then, I've happily returned many times, but this one feels a bit different. I stand here as thrilled and excited as a kid attending his first big league game, but now I bring with me a lifetime of baseball memories. Those memories, those moments, and the people connected to them are very much in my thoughts today, especially my family and close friends who are here with me. My love and appreciation for all of you runs too deep for mere mentions to do them justice. We know what those feelings are and what those bonds mean. In a sense, my journey to Cooperstown began behind the wheel of a 1962 Ford Galaxy. I was 12, and therefore without a driver's license. But that didn't matter, because my purpose wasn't to cruise around the block. No. In those nearly prehistoric times, before cable TV, smartphones, and the internet, a fan's primary connection to baseball was through radio. And at night, at least, reception was better in the driveway than in the house. So, while I could listen to Mel Allen and Red Barber on the Yankees, and Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy on the newly minted Mets, there was even more baseball waiting for me out in the car. So I'd grab my dad's keys, slip behind the wheel, and turn the ignition key to the right. Not far enough to rev the engine, but just enough to light up the dashboard and the radio. And then, from in front of a suburban house on Long Island, I'd travel from city to city, ballpark to ballpark, calibrating that dial like a safecracker until through the crackle and static, I picked up the irrepressible Bob Prince on KDKA in Pittsburgh, the warm and welcoming baritone of Chuck Thompson on WBAL in Baltimore, and the pleasing pace and phrasings of Ernie Harwell on WJR in Detroit. Who somehow always seemed to know that when a foul ball drifted into the stands, the souvenir would be taken home by a lad from Lansing or a kid from Kalamazoo. Wade Hoyt called games on WLW, describing the exploits of Frank Robinson and Veda Pinson and the quirky dimensions of Crosley Field, all the while spinning yarns about his days as Babe Ruth's teammate with the Murderers Row Yankees. Sometimes I'd find Earl Gillespie calling a homer by Hank Aaron or Eddie Matthews from Milwaukee, which was all Warren Spahn was going to need because, as Earl told me, Spahny really had that screwball working tonight. Oh, and by the way, I'm pretty sure Joe Torre was the catcher the night in 1963 when a 42-year-old Warren Spahn went 16 shutout innings against a 23-year-old Juan Marichal until Willie Mays homered in the bottom of the 16th to win the game 1-0. And Juan told me once, I mean, that was baseball in 1963 when I was 11. And I remember Juan telling me that he told Alvin Dark, the manager, after about the 13th, I can't go any longer. Or maybe Alvin Dark said, listen, you see that man over there? He's 42 years old. You're going back out there. And he did. And on those evenings when the atmospheric conditions were just right, KMOX would magically appear out of St. Louis, bringing with it the dynamic pairing of Harry Carey and Jack Buck, each distinctively great. Harry, booming and bombastic, a showman. Jack, sophisticated and more restrained, possessed of a dry wit and a wide broadcasting range that included the ability to capture and amplify a game's most exciting and important moments. Full disclosure here now. Some of those trips to the driveway were actually my earliest reporting assignments. You see, my dad was a big-time gambler, and there were times when the mortgage was riding on whether or not Camilo Pascual could get Al Kaline out, or whether Roberto Clemente could come through with the bases loaded. And it was my job to get the details and then report the news, good or bad, to my dad. In a sense then, our father and son connection was more Damon Runyon than Norman Rockwell. But that connection was real. And when it came to baseball and its soundtrack, that connection was enduring. To me, the games were inseparable from the voices who brought them to me. I was fascinated by how the best of them had a rhythm that was in sync with the rhythms of the game itself, and how it wasn't just what they said, but how they said it, that gave the game a melody. By then, I had already wisely concluded that if I was ever going to get into a major league game without purchasing a ticket, it wouldn't be to succeed Willie Mays in center field, but instead to sit in the catbird seat, as Red Barber called it, behind a microphone, looking out over the action. If on radio, trying to paint a picture. If on television, trying to put the right caption beneath the picture. 12 years old, and all I wanted to be was a sportscaster, especially a baseball broadcaster. Maybe, I thought, if I worked at it, I could one day become good enough to do it for a living and to be part of baseball. It was beyond my wildest hopes and fanciful thoughts that one day this sort of recognition would come my way. So I hope you can understand my genuine appreciation for what this award represents and how meaningful and humbling it is for me to have my name linked with those who have preceded me in the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame. That talented roster includes a number of guys I've been lucky enough to work with. Back in the early 80s, Tim McCarver and I actually did a handful of games together on NBC. The first, Red Sox at Angels, was so long ago that Yaz hit a homer and Rod Carew stole a base. Like Tim, Tony Kubek and Bob Uecker have also received the Ford C. Frick Award, although Uecker remains ticked off that he was somehow overlooked as a player. And with a lifetime batting average of exactly 200 and 14 career home runs spread over 7 seasons with 6 different clubs, you can appreciate the injustice of it all. Picture this scene at the 1995 World Series. Game 6 in Atlanta on NBC. On my right, Joe Morgan, first ballot Hall of Famer, two-time MVP, one of the greatest second basemen in baseball history. And to my left, Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker. For the sake of context and contrast, Just to cite one of Uke's many amazing records, he once led the National League in pass balls with 27 while playing in only 76 games. I mean, that's making the most of your opportunities. You know how on the back of a baseball card there'll be some sort of superlative about the player? Clayton Kershaw. Clayton has won 3 Cy Young Awards. Jose Altuve. Jose has led the league in hits 4 straight years. I just happen to have Bob Uecker's baseball card right here. And on the back of the card, it says, Bob once got out of a rundown against the Phillies. So anyway, here we are up in the booth. And Joe starts talking about his own World Series experiences. Stories about Johnny Bench and Sparky Anderson and Pete Rose and Tony Perez. And then, partly just to amuse myself, I turn to Uecker and I say, Uke, did you ever play in the World Series? He said, well, I was with the Cardinals in 64, but when we played the Yankees in the World Series, I was on the disabled list. I said, what was wrong with you? He said, I had hepatitis. I said, how did you get that? He said, the trainer injected me with it. Which may in large part explain why the Cardinals won that World Series over the Yankees. So, Uecker, McCarver, and Kubek are all in the broadcaster's wing. And my past and present partners, Joe Morgan and John Smoltz, are of course enshrined as players. Over the last several years at the MLB Network, I've also worked a lot of games with Jim Cott, although work probably misstates it because it's always so comfortable and such a pleasure. And by the way, here's a respectful memo to the Veterans Committee, just so I can run the table on Hall of Fame partners. With more than 280 career wins, 16 gold gloves, and 6 decades as an exemplary citizen of the game, you can make a pretty good case that Kitty deserves to sign autographs with HOF beside his name as well. Jim Cott, Bob Uecker, Tim McCarver, Joe Morgan, John Smoltz, they're all here today, and I'm very glad they are. Only one of my longtime partners is missing, and it's the one to whom I am most indebted. Tony Kubek is doing fine. He's still as sharp as ever. He still looks 20 years younger than his birth certificate indicates, but some physical limitations that trace to his playing days have made it difficult for him to travel. He really wanted to be here, and he asked me to send his best to all those here who he played with or against and whose games he called. Back in 1983, NBC had a chance to hire Vin Scully. When you have that chance, you take it. It made sense to pair Vin with Joe Garagiola. Talk about a Hall of Fame booth. But that meant that Tony would go to the B game with me. This was Tony Kubek. He had played on 7 Yankee pennant winners. He had worked the game of the week, the All-Star game, and the World Series with Kurt Gowdy and Joe Garagiola. In baseball circles, he was universally respected and admired. I was completely unproven and pretty much unknown outside my adopted hometown of St. Louis. Another guy might have treated me like a pebble in his shoe, a reminder of what some could have wrongly perceived as his diminished standing, but not Tony. From day one, he treated me as an equal, and we clicked right away, both personally and professionally. We were well received. One observer said we were reverent and irreverent at the same time. I liked that. But most important of all, Tony vouched for me. At the batting cages, in the clubhouses, in the dugouts, he introduced me to everyone I'd need to know, managers, coaches, players, scouts, and the message was clear. If this kid is okay with me, he should be okay with you as well. He paved the way for me. I've never forgotten that, and I'll always be grateful to him. I will also always be grateful to the great fans of St. Louis. The argument about what the best baseball town is pointless. There are several who can make a case. They all have their individual charms and history and appeal. But St. Louis has to be somewhere on that list. The combination of passion and knowledge and civility and history and tradition. And in the 1980s, when I was making whatever mark I made nationally in baseball, St. Louis was a great place to be around the game. Not just the games you broadcast, but the games you attended with your children and with your friends, just to be around baseball and to soak up the atmosphere. And first Whitey Herzog, and then Joe Torre, and then Tony La Russa, and Hall of Fame players like Ozzie Smith and Bob Gibson and Lou Brock and Bruce Sutter and Red Shandings, whom we just lost, and of course Stan Musial. They couldn't have been kinder to me. And those Herzog teams of the 80s played an exciting and nuanced style of baseball that really rewarded those who loved and paid attention to the game. And even though I never broadcast Cardinal games specifically, I was a baseball guy, St. Louis was my home, and people there treated me like one of their own, and they still do. And I'll always be grateful for that. Broadcasting a ball game, especially on television, is a collaborative effort. And at NBC, and now MLBN, I've been blessed with terrific collaborators. Not just those I've sat alongside in the booth, but those I've worked for and with. Producers, directors, researchers, camera people. No single one of us made those broadcasts everything they were. We did it together, and more often than not, we elevated each other. My appreciation and fondness for those colleagues, past and present, is real and enduring. I wish I could mention each and every one of them, but if there's anything TV people understand, it's time constraints. And so this one story, connected to one of baseball's most unforgettable moments, will have to serve as an example, writ large, of the sort of masterful work so many of those people did, and from which we as broadcasters and you as the audience benefited. It's October of 1988, the Dodgers and A's in Game 1 of the World Series at Dodger Stadium. Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola in the booth. Mike Weissman and John Filippelli overseeing the production from the truck. Producers who were sharp and spontaneous. They valued talented people who thought for themselves, and they let you be yourself. The late Harry Coyle directed that game. He virtually invented the way a baseball game should be directed, going all the way back to the first World Series telecast in the 1940s. And he did it with an intuitive feel for the pace and flow of the game, a kind of genius that couldn't so much be explained as felt. The A's were overwhelming favorites, even more so because the Dodgers were both outmanned and shorthanded. The storyline was obvious, but how that story was told, that was the key. As the pregame host, I came on first, and in the gathering twilight at Dodger Stadium, I stated what we thought was true. Kirk Gibson will not play tonight. He will not even suit up. He is not available for so much as pinch-hitting duty. As the game unfolded, Vin Scully, with his unparalleled sense of how to frame a developing narrative, asked Harry Coyle from time to time to pan the dugout. And he mentioned, as the Dodgers fell behind in the game, that not only were they behind, but they were without the guy who would become that year's National League MVP. Now it's late in the game. The A's are leading 4-3. I'm in the corner of the Dodger dugout, waiting to jump out on the field and conduct some kind of interview with somebody, no matter how the game turns out. Meanwhile, back in the Dodger clubhouse, Gibson is on the trainer's table in his skivvies, and he hears Vin Scully say, "Well, Kirk Gibson won't play tonight." And Gibson, by his own testimony, pounded the table and said, "My ass." He picked himself up, he pulled on his uniform, and he walked down to the batting cage between the dugout and the clubhouse. And from my perch in the corner of the dugout, I could hear the sound of a bat meeting a ball. And so I walked down to investigate. And there was Kirk Gibson. And with every swing, it was thwack, and a ball boy would place another ball on a tee. Thwack, This went on for a while. I contacted Mike Weissman in the truck, and I said, "Gibson's taking swings. He might be able to pinch hit." He passed that information on to Vin and Joe, and Harry Coyle panned the dugout. And Vin knew that there was the possibility. Who knew how it would pay off? But there was that possibility. Tommy Lasorda never let on. He had Dave Anderson in the on-deck circle while Mike Davis stood at the plate with two out and nobody on, and Dennis Eckersley, Hall of Famer, virtually untouchable, the game's best relief pitcher, needed one more out to retire the side and end the game. On a 3-2 pitch, he missed and Davis walked. And only then did Kirk Gibson emerge from the dugout and Vinny said, "And look who's coming up." And then there ensued, so that the drama and anticipation could build, luckily for all of us, a long at-bat. Gibson didn't hit the first pitch. The count went to 3-2. There were foul balls, one of which was a little dribbler up the first baseline, and you could see Gibson limping. You thought, well, if he hit the ball off the right field wall, they'd probably throw him out at first base. The tension built and built, and then you know what happened. Somehow, some way, just with his arms, hardly striding, he hit the ball out of the ballpark. Vinny's call was, of course, perfect, with the perfect punctuation. In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened. And people rightly focus on that. But what you might overlook is this, the way Harry Coyle directed that sequence. This wasn't a movie. This was live. He had one shot at it. The next time you see that play, look at the way it's cut. The ball leaves Gibson's bat. The arc of the ball is followed toward the stands in right field. But then they get back to Gibson as he rounds first, and they catch him pumping his arm between first and second. They get Dennis Eckersley turning his head, staring in near disbelief. They get Tony La Russa walking down the tunnel, shaking his head, leaving the dugout. They get Tommy Lasorda jumping up, at least as high as he could jump, off the top step of the dugout. But they get back to Gibson in time to see him slap hands with Joey Amalfitano, the third base coach. And then they get the meeting at home plate with all of his teammates there to greet him. They get it from Gibson's perspective as he approaches them, and then from behind them as they wait to embrace Kirk Gibson. Kirk Gibson had one turn at bat. So did Harry Coyle. So did John Filippelli and Mike Weissman in the booth. Every live shot, every replay, every single one picture perfect. If you went back 30 years now and wanted to change any of it, you'd look at it and you'd say, we can't improve on it. I jumped out on the field. I interviewed Kirk Gibson. It was more about the emotion than any particulars. And then, as we walked away from the ballpark, still in the afterglow of one of the most truly remarkable moments any of us had ever been part of, I mentioned to our pregame producer, David Neal, that Gibson's homer seemed so cinematic that it reminded me of Robert Redford's last at-bat as Roy Hobbs in The Natural, which had come out only a few years before. David took it from there. Using scenes from The Natural, so beautifully directed by Barry Levinson, with Robert Redford as the star and Randy Newman's score, he intercut Kirk Gibson's at-bat with Roy Hobbs' at-bat. And it was eerie how so many of those scenes mirrored each other. Now, Gibson didn't have a bullet wound that was bleeding through his jersey, but he was limping around, just as Redford was. And when contact was made, their swings, especially when we showed Kirk's in slow motion, seemed similar. The way their actions mirrored each other as they rounded the bases. And even Wilford Brimley, as the manager of the New York Knights, jumping up in the air, looked pretty much like Tommy Lasorda. And they each got just enough altitude that maybe you could have slipped a lineup card beneath their spikes. The way reality melded with mythology was striking. Kirk Gibson did it. He created that moment. He was the epicenter of it. And yet, even Kirk himself will tell you that he now recalls it largely through the prism of how it was described by Vin Scully, visually captured by Harry Coyle, and then romanticized by David Neal. That Kirk Gibson moment is as theatrical as any baseball has ever produced, and it featured simultaneously two of the greatest calls in the game's history. Vin Scully on television and Jack Buck on radio. I don't believe what I just saw. The talent and sense of the moment displayed by those two first-team Hall of Fame broadcasters reminds us that while the game is the thing and the players are the stars, how those games are perceived and remembered is often shaped by those who chronicle them. Think of Bobby Thompson's homer in 1951, the shot heard round the world. Most of us don't really recall it firsthand. It just seems as if we do, because Russ Hodges' ecstatic exclamation, "The Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant," echoes down the corridors of time. For those of us who saw him pitch, the excellence and elegance of Sandy Koufax spoke for themselves. But then listen to Vin Scully's call of the full ninth inning of Sandy's perfect game. More than a half century later, it still raises goosebumps. The building drama and anticipation, the meticulous attention to detail, the keen eye of the reporter blended with the graceful prose of a poet. A perfect performance on the mound, matched and enhanced by a perfect performance in the booth. These days, when we think of Al Michaels, we tend to think of football or even hockey, where he provided the simple yet perfect punctuation for the miracle on ice. But Al was also a Hall of Fame caliber baseball announcer. His calls of Johnny Bench's home run that propelled the Reds to the World Series in 72, or the epic fifth game of the 86 ALCS between the Angels and Red Sox, are more than proof enough of that. Big moments made to feel even bigger when the right guy is at the mic. I hope that one day Al gets to stand here and receive this award, because he too deserves it. When we think of those broadcasters and others who could both rise to the big occasion and also just be a genial companion helping you enjoy a ball game, it's a reminder of how, while the players are always at the heart of it, the writers, the broadcasters, the filmmakers, and documentarians who have best captured the essence of the game are also part of the rich history and texture of our national pastime. Over the last few months, the congratulatory phone calls, letters, and texts from Hall of Fame players, managers, and executives have meant a lot to me. But perhaps most meaningful of all is that some of the very best baseball broadcasters ever, people I truly admire, decided collectively that in one way or another, I had contributed enough to the game to join their ranks. Because after all, it's only the past winners of the Ford C. Frick Award, along with a small group of broadcasting historians, who each year make that decision. This past December, on the day my selection was announced, among the first to call me was Vin Scully. Even on a winter morning, that voice shines like a sunbeam. He was his typically gracious and engaging self. And he concluded by saying, "Bob, I couldn't be happier for you. Welcome to the club. Let's see, a club where there's no initiation fee, no annual dues, and Vin Scully is a prominent member? Yeah, I'm good with that." That same morning, just a short time later, Dick Enberg was on the line. Dick was a brilliantly accomplished broadcaster on a wide range of sports. But baseball was always his favorite, and his call that day now seems especially poignant. He said he was hoping that Trevor Hoffman would make it in the player voting the following month. That way, I will be in Cooperstown for Trevor and for you. That was the last thing I ever heard him say. Less than a week later, he was gone. We all wish Dick could be here this weekend. His presence always enhanced any occasion. But in a sense, he is here and always will be. That's part of the beauty of the Hall of Fame. Like Dick Enberg in his category, the six we will celebrate tomorrow become certified baseball immortals. They are eternal citizens of Cooperstown, an eternal part of the history of the game. Membership here isn't for a lifetime, it's for all time. And it's part of baseball's unique appeal that in some cases, those enshrined here are forever linked with men they never knew. Cal Ripken with Lou Gehrig, Nolan Ryan with Walter Johnson, Hank Aaron with Babe Ruth. The richness of its fabric, the depth and significance of its history, the generational connections, they all set baseball apart. Good broadcasters know how to tell a story. No game has more good stories to tell than baseball. I've had a very fortunate career filled with vivid experiences. The Olympics, the NBA, HBO, you name it. I've enjoyed and appreciated them all. But for me, baseball has always come first. And so, this day and this honor will always come first too. Thank you all very much.